Hi everyone, it's Adam from Monkey Tennis here. Just saying a huge thank you to all of you that have supported my charity appeal so far. For those that haven't heard about it, this September I'm going to be swimming 15 kilometres between five islands in Cornwall. I'll be swimming the Isles of Scilly, that's Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. I'm doing it because I want to, but also to raise money for CALM, the campaign against living miserably. It's a well-known statistic that 125 people in the UK die by suicide every week, and CALM run a free and confidential helpline for people to speak through their problems and ultimately to help prevent suicides. I'm looking to raise enough money to train two new phone workers to man those lines, and I'll be doing it by swimming the Isles of Scilly in Cornwall. If you're looking to support me, it would be greatly appreciated. You can donate at justgiving.com. Just go there and search for Adam Swim Scilly. That's Adam Swim Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. All donations greatly appreciated. Thank you for helping me to support CALM. And now, on with Monkey Tennis.
A lot can happen in 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, listeners. Before we start this week's show, it's just time for a quick reminder, and in fact, the final reminder about Monkey Tennis Live. We're all going to be there live on stage at London's Prince Charles Cinema next Wednesday, November 22nd, to chat through Alan's Christmas special, Knowing Me, Knowing You All. Well, hopefully we'll all be there, as long as we can get Nick out of the bogs before the show starts, and if needs be, Jed can probably step in to take his place. Anyway, even better than all that, don't forget we're going to be joined live by Simon Greenall, otherwise known as everyone's favourite work Geordie and possibly Alan's only friend, Michael. He's emailed us this week to say how excited he is. Needless to say, we're also ruddy bloody excited. It's going to be brilliant. We'll be trying to answer all the big questions such as, is Michael really dead? How many customers did he hit? Why is he not allowed to handle cash? And is Nick really still in the bogs? If you have any of your own Michael-specific questions, do send them our way. Let's face it, you're not going to want to miss this. Tickets are selling fast, so make sure you book. All you need to do is go to postpoppodcast.com/monkeytennislive for the details. And now, on with the episode.
Monkey Tennis? Smelly Alan Fartridge.
Linton Travel Tavern seemed an obvious choice.
Monkey Tennis?
At the BBC, of all places. Be real.
Monkey Tennis?
Where's my assistant? I do not know.
Monkey Tennis?
I wish things had turned out differently, but I'm glad they didn't.
Monkey Tennis?
It will be called Alan's Show. I decided, and would be absolutely ace.
Monkey Tennis?
But needless to say, I had the last laugh.
Pitter-patter, pitter-patter, pitter-patter. It's the sound of a new episode of Monkey Tennis landing in your ears. Hello, welcome to Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge fan podcast. I'm Adam Brooks, and I'm joined by Tom Dark.
Like a good-looking John Merrick, mine was a face that looked really shit.
Nick Alder. And Tom Stab.
It was Pepsi or Shirley from Pepsi and Shirley.
So we're heading towards the end of I, Partridge now. We've been tackling the book a few chapters each week. We're up to chapter 26, My Drink and Drugs Heck. Is there any musical accompaniment for
there
this?
There is no mandatory listening for this chapter.
Interesting.
Fair enough. So we're onto my section of the book now, the final nine chapters. One thing that's notable about this section of the book, obviously throughout the book, Alan has talked down about, dissed, insulted and blamed an awful lot of people. But this section of the book, he goes fairly easy on people. The only people he talks down to insults or blames are John Merrick, Birds of a Feather, his assistant, Eamon Holmes, society, Kraft Foods, the government.
Only a few people.
Pepsi or Shirley out of Pepsi and Shirley. Bill Oddie, Therapy, Paedophiles, Fern Cotton, Cliff Richard, Ham, Cannibals, People from Papua New Guinea, Tesco's, Swans in Labour, Russell Harty, Ray Clements, Carol, and Norwich City Council. His publishing company, Twitchness, Mike Tyson, Toya Wilcox, the IRA, Richard Madeley, Domestic Toilet Paper, Next, Lynn's mum, Alan's mum, Grand Designs, the couples who appear on Grand Designs, Architects, Builders, Jimmy Savile, David Essex, The Travelling Community, Londoners, Aldershot, Children, Dave Clifton, Jesus, Jeremy Clarkson, The Swaffham Vauxhall Dealership, Dennis Nielsen, Jeff Dahmer, Boy George, Adrian Charles, Dogs Baptist, Peter Sutcliffe, Freddie Mercury, Simon Mayo, Simon Bates, Gravity, You Can Call Me Al by Paul Simon, Bus Fares and Security Guards.
Extensive. So,
have you finished?
Is that definitely finished?
I'm done.
So he's mellowed in age.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. So it opens, obviously, at the height of his Toblerone addiction, with him making all sorts of awful noises, and he's questioning, the noises are coming from my mouth. How long have I been making them? I do not know. Where on earth am I? I do not know. Where's my assistant? I do not know. The implication there that she should be around and available 100% of the time.
Of course. Yep.
He starts to describe the things in his mouth. Sharp-cornered, spearing, stabbing, blood. All words he uses. The clues are there that he's talking about Toblerone. He also uses pitter-patter again, which is a frequent literary thing throughout the book. Pitter-patter went the rain, as if bookending my short and ultimately unhappy life. Which I think, is that the first time he's admitted that his life's a failure?
Well, I think he's just trying to amp up the misery vibe again in this chapter, isn't he?
Yeah.
There's also a bit in the book, I'm not quite sure how they tackled this in the audiobook, where he basically shouts, "My assistant," but in real life he's shouting her name.
My assistant!
Going to such lengths to avoid, like, it would just be easier to use her name, wouldn't it? But no. He also starts to see himself as being separate from his own body. My face, my lovely face, was now unspeakably bloated, blotchy skin struggling to contain the expanding Alan within.
Very nicely put.
A lot of his best descriptions are actually of his own messiness. He says, ravaged by addiction, it was now home to jowls, eyes and chin that were being dragged torso-wards by the weight of their gelatinous content.
This is just him getting a bit old and fat, isn't it?
Yeah, let's be honest.
Well, he's more than a bit fat.
Fat, tired, confused, cold, obese, alone, and with chilly feet. So he also says, I forced more prisms of Toblerone and waited for death to come, which made me wonder if anyone had ever died of chocolate overdose, how easy that is. So I looked up a few factoids. Dogs obviously can.
Yes.
The fatal dose of chocolate for dogs is 1 ounce per pound of dog. The elderly and young humans are quite susceptible. You would have to have approximately 40 bars of dairy milk to succumb to theobromide poisoning. Oh. So, yeah, chocolate can kill a man.
Wow.
But if you're a blackbird, you've got to be a lot more careful. The, the regulation dose of chocolate to kill a blackbird is 1 smarty.
Wow.
That's a fact I looked up.
Excellent.
Good work.
Yeah. Thanks, the internet.
So is it worth just clarifying for those picking up? So, obviously, this chapter, this is Alan's telling of events of when he basically has the mental breakdown and drives to Dundee in his bare feet.
Well, he says he hits rock bottom, and I still don't think that this is rock bottom. It's just, this is how he sees rock bottom, but I think we also need to remember the Forbes McAllister incident. There's been many a rock bottom.
Yeah, but this is when he's most mentally anguished, because he's basically recorded too many episodes of Skirmish in a row.
And it's pushed him over the edge.
Yeah.
But what I like about this chapter, I was going to say that, you know, the fact that we're getting Alan's side from an incident which is only kind of, it's referenced in I, Partridge, and there are a few flashbacks, but we never like see or hear the full event in detail until this book.
Yes, and the reasons he says that drove him to this drink and drugs heck were a divorce, multiple career snubs, accusations from the family of a dead celebrity, presumably Forbes McAllister, estranged kids, although that's been going on for a while. I don't think you can really use that now. You know, they've been estranged for ages. Borderline homelessness, that kind of thing.
Well, I guess he's just adding it all together, isn't he? So his brain being an imaginary piece of tofu having thumbs of bad news forced into it.
Yeah, that metaphor is bizarre. Yes. at one point he's talking about thumbs, then the thumbs become bad news, then they turn back into thumbs again. It's absolute nonsense. He then starts talking about misery lit as well, which obviously is what this is trying to
be. Yes, absolutely.
Gets angry at the naysayers who try to downplay the very real horror of chocolate addiction. And he says, but I'm getting ahead of myself. So he tells us how he got there, takes us back to 1987 and Alan's introduction to Toblerone when he's back at R Price Radio. I looked up a little bit about R Price. Nothing that scandalous, but it started in 1971. It folded in 2004. The headquarters were in High Street, Kensington, where some of the Monkey Tennis team work. Mm-hmm. It was sold to W.H. Smith's. The founders left to form MVC, if anybody remembers that.
So does that mean that it was going in 2003?
2004, well, it was sold to Virgin in 1998, and if you remember, they started to change them into V-shops and put mobile phones in the back. Anyway, that's my R Price summary in a nutshell.
Great. Yeah. Enjoyed it.
And yeah, it's Pepsi or Shirley from Pepsi and Shirley that first introduced Alan to Toblerone.
And we never find out which one it is because he does not know the difference.
He also says that he was out on the town with them and fellow DJ John Boyd, who he claims is who's a housewife's choice on Mid-Morning Radio Leeds. John Boyd is a real person, and there's a description of him on his agent's website, which is positively Partridge-esque. It says, Wilf Paish MBE, the famous Olympic coach, made this statement about John Boyd. In radio broadcasting terms, John Boyd is a natural, that's in quotation marks. He is the equivalent in broadcasting of a gold medalist. No amount of training, study or reading can hope to turn a cart horse into a Grand National winner.
Wow.
So I wonder if he's quoted in here because John Boyd is actually one of the many inspirations for Alan. He seems like quite a similar character. Yeah.
Can I ask a quick question, just going back a step? Had anyone heard of Pepsi and Shirley or any music by Pepsi and Shirley before
I'd heard
this
of.
Book?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. They're like part of Wham, aren't they?
Well, yeah, they're kind of like almost like the dancers and vocalists.
So I didn't really know who they were.
Yes,
so they were on stage until the Brits.
Has anybody not Googled them and seen what they look like
because the point is
we're missing a massive
gag. They don't look anything like.
One is black, one is white.
Yeah. Oh, I see.
Yeah, that's the joke.
That's the joke.
Of course, got you. So yeah, he takes a mouthful of Toblerone as supplied by Pepsi or Shirley, and at that moment, his life changes forever. At this point, he reverts back to speaking in the first person.
He does recognise, to be fair, that up until that point, he had suffered from a fat back, but that was the only part of him that was in any way fat.
Yep, the rest of him soon raced to catch up. Yeah. He says, he saw his mind diving and soaring into a new ecstasy as he tried it. I felt amazing. Gold-plated Vanden Plas. Now, I had to look up the reference for Vanden Plas, but they produce bodies for specialist car manufacturers. It's a Coogan reference. It's an Alan reference.
Yep.
It's not very much an Adam reference. So there we go. He then says later on, I thought nothing is until late. Several years later, I was sexually assaulted. I had my pants removed and arse exposed by hooligans at a live Comic Relief event.
Has everybody seen that, by the way? That's brilliant.
Yes, absolutely wonderful. So that was when he was on Comic Relief in 1995. And someone turns up with a cheque for £75, which he's very not impressed by. And it's the guy who later plays Sweaty Raphael in I'm Alan Partridge.
Right. And doesn't he reference that in relation to Utri and why he may or may not be on that list?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah.
And John Thompson's also in the Comic Relief sketch as well, a recurring Alan player. Alan's done 5 Comic Reliefs and a Sport Relief, I checked over the years. Which
was it 5? I didn't realise it was that many.
Yeah, I believe so.
Can I just, this could be a stupid question, but he has had chocolate before. Is there just something about the powerful combination of honey and nougat and chocolate in Toblerone that sends him over the edge?
I think so.
I think that's what triggers the addictive nature for him.
And I'm sure you're about to say, yes, that's the joke, but Toblerone is pretty standard, right? It's nothing special.
No. Can I just shock you? I don't even like Toblerone that much.
But to him, it's exotic, isn't it? To him, it's like, it's the exotic. He's trying to draw a parallel with the exotic feeling of, you know, someone doing heroin for the first time.
Well, that's obviously an overriding joke throughout this chapter. The way he writes about it, it's like he's describing some kind of severe heroin addiction. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
but it's just
Toblerone. Absolutely.
Don't downplay chocolate addiction.
No. It's a very serious affliction.
Yes.
Question to the group: What is your favourite Alan-based chocolate? So, for example, I'm not a big fan of Toblerone, but I do love a chocolate orange.
It's the question, what's your favourite chocolate bar?
Well, but Alan-related.
Alan-related.
I would go chocolate orange as well. I'm not anti...
What are the others?
I'm not anti-Toblerone. If someone comes up to me and says, do you want a piece of Toblerone?
Toblerone Toffos? And chocolate orange.
Yeah. Yeah. Toffos of chocolate.
Toffos, chocolate orange, or Toblerone, I think, is the only, is the choice we're facing.
Chocolate orange?
Yeah. I go Toblerone. I like a Toblerone.
No.
Especially salted caramel.
Right, as we talk about this, Jed is currently opening a Kinder Egg.
God, I want some.
Not an affiliated.
Not to say he hasn't got his eyes on the price.
That is not on brand. You should be paying attention to the recording.
Jed, I'm going to give you a one-word option here. Out of Toblerone, chocolate orange, we'll call that one word, or Toffos, what would be your favourite?
Before you answer, can I just stress, if you say burger sauce, I'm going to boot you.
Toblerone.
Interesting. I'm glad we had this little chat.
Join us later when we find out what toy Jed has inside his Kinder Egg.
So Alan's addiction is ramping up. He says, after Carol left, I'd sometimes get up in the night and eat a whole Toblerone to myself. And I'm not talking about a small one. I mean a medium-sized one.
that is a classic line in the book.
Large would be insane. He was, by some distance, his only admission, the most depressed and troubled man in the UK. I find that difficult to believe. And he shrunk into a dark cranny of fed-upness. He has trouble talking about his own depression, doesn't he? He likes to sort of cage it within softer language, dark cranny of fed-upness, clinically fed up, etc.
And to clarify that a large Toblerone would be insanity, a cursory Google search tells me you can buy a jumbo Toblerone, which is 4.5 kilograms.
I think we discussed this on the podcast previously, and isn't it like 80 quid or something?
Yeah, it's $79.99, and only 8 left in stock on Amazon. Buy it now.
I'm keen to see the reviews. Are there any 1-star reviews of that?
Is it available on Prime? Can we get it delivered this afternoon?
It is available on Prime.
Promotional pictures are ridiculous.
Whilst Tom looks into that, Alan describes the severity of his problem as saying that he was starting to get routinely mistaken for Eamon Holmes.
But also the way that he describes his consumption of it, so he says, I can't confront my demons, it's too much, so if I have an argument with Carol, 3 slabs and I'll be fine. It's just like, 3 slabs, this is not chocolate, you know, this is not major addiction. That's what a normal person would do if they were stressed.
Yeah, exactly, and I love that he describes it as a slab.
Can I just point out, so the top 5-star review for this massive Toblerone on Amazon just says, I feel sick.
From Alan in Norwich. 50.
This basically all adds up, and then he says, I lost control and I ended up driving to Dundee in bare feet. I had a little look at this drive in detail. Norwich to Dundee is 445 miles and would take 7 hours and 49 minutes. He says, I remember literally nothing of my journey to Scotland before then describing every single road he travelled on. I did cross-check those against Google Maps, and his route does check out. That is legitimately the way to get to Dundee.
Yeah, I figured they wouldn't have just messed around with that. They were going to take it seriously.
When he eventually comes to his senses, he says, I didn't feel up to the drive home, not least because I had no shoes and felt daft. So I contacted my assistant, who travelled overnight, while I lay across the generously proportioned backseat of the Vectra, finishing the last of the Toblerones. I love that it's sort of, he realises that he's had an episode, but he's still, he can't leave the Toblerones unfinished, can he?
But then also, is obviously with the unreliable narrator nature of this, the fact that he thinks he's had an episode, I mean, yes, we know that he's got a bit fat and he hasn't got shoes, but it's like he's saying he blacked out while he remembers the whole journey, and he writes about how he's kind of getting over the episode, but yet he's still snacking on Toblerone. I mean, essentially, nothing bad really happened.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And he hasn't. And also, on the way back, he's criticising Lynn's driving, which he drives him home. He says, for such a bird-like woman, she was far too hard on the clutch, so after a few hundred metres, I took over and drove home myself.
So again, it can't be that bad.
Yeah.
It's probably worth mentioning as well that he writes, my assistant doesn't own a car, and the train was, I felt, too expensive, so she'd taken the National Express coach.
Anyone checked how much it is to get a train from Norwich to Dundee?
We've done some price comparison here, so Alan does kind of have a point. The a single train ticket, looking at this on the trainline.com today, is £145 Norwich to Dundee
versus £35.20 on the coach.
So a considerable saving there. Alan was right there.
Yeah. Just put her on the coach and then dock it out of her wages. when he eventually gets home, it's worth mentioning in this chapter, titled My Drink and Drugs Heck, he's yet to take a single drink or drug, but that's about to change. I got home and had a can of bitter and a sleeping tablet. So that is the that's the heck.
I love that. Which goes, the drink part of this chapter.
Also probably worth a quick mention that he says, Lynn quickly washed and shod me and then began the drive home. But which obviously we covered, then he takes over the driving. But also, there's a hose pipe dangling from the exhaust like the tail of a giant mouse. And then there's a footnote that follows. Oh, I should have said this was for a suicide bid, which I didn't get around to. That is purely a throwaway footnote.
Do we think that's actually true?
No, I think he should chuck that in there.
Do you reckon he should chuck that in?
The whole chapter, to be honest, is a bit of a nonsense. I mean, he talks again about who's to blame, me, society, Kraft Foods, the government, Pepsi or Shirley, out of Pepsi or Shirley. He kind of says it's a combination of all of them with a slight weighting towards Pepsi and Shirley.
See, I actually think that him doing this and framing it as a suicide bid in Alan Universe probably is true, but the fact that he was never really going to go through with it anyway.
No.
Yeah, and it's because he didn't get round to it. Not because he changed his mind. Not because he didn't get round to it. Speaking of information he just throws out apropos of nothing, he also says after the can of bitter and sleeping tablet incident, he says, I subsequently made a number of changes to my life which resulted in me getting better.
Yeah, and then the absolutely footnote, glosses over it.
The footnote claims that, well, although apparently it's down to the publishers, because he says this paragraph is an edited version of a much longer passage, which the publishers felt borrowed too heavily from Bouncing Back, available in secondhand bookshops in and around Norfolk.
Nice. Not outside of the Norfolk area.
No, presumably before the books were pulped, I think he probably took a couple of hundred and just distributed them evenly across the charity shops of Norwich.
Yeah.
So that brings us pretty much to the end of My Drinking Drugs Heck and straight on to chapter 27, Chin Up.
So the mandatory listening for this chapter is a song called Cakewalk Into Town by Taj Mahal. I do not know that song.
Never heard of it.
Again, it's on the Spotify playlist, so enjoy it in your leisure.
It's not long into this chapter before Sue Cook rears her head again.
Yep.
She calls and offers to take Alan to the zoo. She never actually turned up, but then she never does. That's just Sue, as she always says. And then he says Bill Oddie was a real rock too. Sue and Bill are getting a lot more coverage in this book even than in I-Man and Partridge,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah. But I like the way that it's consistent, the kind of, I don't know if minor league is quite a fair term, but those kind of like those minor league British celebrities that Alan's actually friends with, that's a consistent through line.
They get more coverage than sort of bigger characters from Alan's past, like Michael and his assistant, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And also the sort of minor grievances of Bill Oddie are so close to being believable that I think that's what makes them funny. For example, he gets very angry when he's with Alan because people are watching birds without binoculars, which, as Bill Oddie states here, is cheating. you also get quite a bit of insight into some of the menial tasks that his assistant has to do for him. She pops around to drop off food, do the dishes, flush the loo, as he tends to forget. He's at my lowest point. She also offered to help me shower. He decided against that. But I did think, is that genuine help or is that sexual interest?
Well, he also says, although technically my employee, I knew that she came around doing all of this as a friend. Absolutely not true. Absolutely not true.
But I really don't. I don't think there's any sexual interest between Alan and Lynn personally.
No, fair enough.
Yeah.
No, I don't really just think there's genuine help.
I think she loves him, but not necessarily like in that. She's lust.
Fond of.
Yeah.
And then, so after Lynn's done all this stuff, gone up on the coach to drive him home, bathed him, clothed him, shod him, flushed his toilet, he then says, I'm surprised she had time to get any actual work done. And I think it was that as much as anything else that forced me to drop her down to a part-time role.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
Shortly after that, we move on to one of Alan's systems. He introduces a lot of systems in this book that we'll get onto forward solutions later on, which is the main one. But one of them is short burst underwater crying, which is one of his... one of the ways he deals with problems. He's put all of that in capitals, which makes me think he's
attempting to trademark.
Yeah, like a copyrighted term. Followed almost immediately by controlled anger release splashing, which I think might be another patented technique of his to deal with the build-up of anger and sadness. He says, against the express wishes of Bill Oddie, I also tried therapy, but it didn't work for him. So what he did was he took up pony trekking.
This is very, very random.
Yes, it's
very
random. It's a real deviation from
I just love the image of it. Like, Alan on a pony is just not right, and that's why it's brilliant.
No, and so you wonder why it appeals to him. He explains it like this. He says he likes it because it's basically like being in charge of a vehicle slash being. They don't criticise you about viewing figures, play hardball over budgets, or fail to recommission your show.
Still very much haunted by that, isn't he? He won't let it go.
Although he will tell you that he's not bothered about it.
Oh, absolutely.
He also then mentions his experience with horses or Know Me Knowing You, although that was obviously a disaster that saw a horse fail to do a jump and then crap on stage.
Just put sponges on the hooves, it'd be fine.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, he seems to think horses are capable of a lot more than they actually are.
Yeah.
So that's why he takes his on a shortcut across a dual carriageway later in the chapter as well. There's a fun bit as well where he goes to watch them get groomed and he says, I really love the fact that it was like a car wash for horses. I really love that fact.
And I felt a little bit sad for Alan here as well, because he goes on to detail one of the stable lads offering him to have a go at cleaning the hooves.
Yeah.
And he says, I got all shy and said no, even though I would have enjoyed it. Not a day goes by when I don't think about that moment. What an error.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's one of the few things that really has actually stayed with Alan.
Yeah. It's very tender, but it's also a little bit homoerotic, that whole section as well.
Yes,
one of the lads offered me to have a go. I got all shy. I did pluck up the confidence to join in the chit-chat. Yeah. And he also then, I think, tying into that, he says he stopped pony tracking. Did anyone see why?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because of Brokeback Mountain.
Yes.
He just didn't feel comfortable.
I think one of the sweetest bits of this chapter is when he's talking about the pony he had been trekking on Treacle. He says, I also friended her on Facebook.
Yeah.
I know it's not actually her that replies, but it's still nice.
Oh, I can appreciate that.
Yep, absolutely.
That's essentially the most kind of unguarded and human we almost see Alan being, the fact that he really loves the ponies.
Yeah, I would agree. But it's not long before his body's become flooded with blubber. It's now home to over 5 stones of excess weight. He's clinically chubbed up.
Yep.
He says he set about one of the most merciless exercise regimes in the history of Norwich. But let's talk about how he got chubbed up. He spent £54,000 in the last few years on Toblerone.
Yep.
That is a number that begs to be crunched. So what I've done
He's equated it into prostitutes as well for you in the book.
Yeah, it's more than most unhappily married men spend on prostitutes in their whole lives. We have crunched this on a previous episode, but I believe I've gone further with the numbers than ever before.
Always deeper.
Let's see. Yeah. Okay, so he says in the last few years, he spent £54,000. Assuming that's £3 per medium Toblerone, that's 18,000 Toblerones. Assuming a few years is 3 years, that's 6,000 Toblerones a year, 750 a month, 25 a day, or 1.04 Toblerones an hour.
Wow.
It's 25
a day.
That is a lot.
I think you'd be more than 5 stone overweight as well.
I think you would as well, and I think you'd have diabetes. As well. He basically got Lynn to go through his house searching for all the hidden Toblerones, including making her check the cisterns of all 3 of his toilets.
As well as flushing them.
Yeah. Yep. She fell off the stepladder when she was checking the loft and cracked her head on the wall.
I love it. Like, really glosses over Lynn basically horrifically injuring herself.
Yeah, she had to get a casualty. Yeah. he said that he found it in an air vent behind the wardrobe, his final Toblerone. It was sat there looking at me like some sort of confectionery Anne Frank, brackets, God, I hate the Nazis. Controversial. He says, I gathered what remained of my Toblerone supply into just 6 bin bags. Again, I've crunched some numbers. Estimating 150 Toblerones per bin bag, that's 900 or 36 days supply by Alan's consumption.
That's a great number crunching, Adam.
Went to a local primary school, wound down the window, and handed bars out to the kids. It was a nice thing to do, and the fact the police were called says more about genuine paedophiles than it does about me.
He's got a point.
Yeah.
You heard from that teacher of yours lately, Tom?
No, I told you his house burnt down.
Oh, that's right. apparently he went to exercise. Lynn offered to join him, but when he thought about her in a leotard, it made him feel all cold inside.
Oh, that's amazing.
Poor Lynn.
To which I think really qualifies, there is no sexual attraction.
Yeah, no. More stats and facts on his chubbed upness. He figured out that he displaced the same amount of water as half a Ford Fiesta. The gross weight of a Ford Fiesta is 1,490 kilograms.
And that's when he uses that literary technique that he uses quite a lot throughout this book. Not bad for a little lad from Norwich. Not bad at all.
Yeah. More ammo on the list of terrible things that Alan makes his assistant do. He used to run along country lanes and make her drive behind him like a Baptist curb crawler. The idea was if he went below a certain speed, she would just blast the horn. This is like the speed remake we're dying out for, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
Starring Alan Partridge.
Yeah, doesn't he say if he drops below his target speed, my assistant was to pull forward and slightly run me over.
Yes, exactly. The toot and shoot technique, as he calls it.
What does slightly run you over mean? Or run me over even?
It's a bit of a nudge.
It's a little bit of a
bump. I would say bump to the ground, but no harm beyond bruising. he then says, how I long to go back to the swimming bars and show those young boys my body once he'd finally got back.
Homoeroticism.
I used to lie in bed imagining them staring at me, my skin glistening under the changing room lights, my body covered in a veil of twinking chlorinated droplets, and it felt good. It felt right.
Yeah, I think someone needs to have a chat with Alan about this sort of stuff, don't they?
A lot of things.
he says that the problem with a sudden weight loss is that it's left him with masses of excess skin. I tried to look up some stuff about excess skin on Wikipedia.
There's not
a lot of detail. So what I then did was googled extreme case excess skin, which is something I advise you never do.
Yeah,
no way.
Not interested in that. Because doesn't he say...
He basically says he'll donate his skin to medical science, which is not a pleasant thought.
but I'm
not even sure you can do that, to be honest, either.
No, he says that he came out of the whole ordeal older and wiser. I mean, certainly older.
Yeah, good point. Just on the excess skin, when he was clothed, it wasn't a problem. He just tucked it into his jeans. That's also a line that he uses when Coogan appeared in character on the Jonathan Ross Show. And he also talks about that.
Lovely. That's the end of Chin Up, with him declaring that he's bounced back, leading us nicely to chapter 28, Bouncing Back. So how are we looking at mandatory soundtrack-wise for this chapter?
Well, mandatory soundtrack for this chapter, we have 2 songs that you must listen to. That's Single Ladies by Beyoncé and Babushka by Kate Bush.
Oh, yes, and
great
yes.
soundtrack. Yeah. Yep.
So he's bouncing back. We're now in the very weird Inception-style territory of reading a man's fake autobiography about another fake autobiography that wasn't really released. Anyway,
He says he's feeling very proud, his chest puffing out like a toad's throat, and he believes now he's written Bouncing Back. Today, Norwich Waterstones. Tomorrow, the Booker Prize for books. Forgetting for a second that the Booker Prize is for fiction, making Bouncing Back ineligible. good that he mentions Norwich Waterstones, because it does exist. It's on Castle Street, and Steve Coogan went there in character to promote this amazing. Very book, didn't he?
Brilliant.
He was introduced as an occasional supporter of human rights when he turned up, and he enters via an escalator. There's a YouTube video, or plenty of YouTube videos of him reading from I Partridge and Norwich Waterstones. I thoroughly recommend it. He then moves on. He's basically moved on 2 years later, I think, at this point, doesn't he? He skips ahead. He returns to the year 2PD, post-Dundee. He's talking about himself in the third person again. He had he's talking about his major male mind meltdown. And then one day in the bathtub, Ulrika, it hit me. So he devises Bouncing Back, which is supposed to be half autobiography, half self-help manual. Again, he's talking systems. It would be a system to set free the limitless potential within us all, which I think, again, is where Alan veers very much into Noel Edmonds territory.
Yeah.
Noel being a purveyor of positive thinking systems and so on. He writes this book, Bouncing Back, in two distinct ways. One is the traditional way, going into his study and pounding away on the word processor. And the other is when he goes jogging with a Bluetooth headset on and gets his assistant to type up the chapters as he speaks them over the phone to her. He says, sometimes he'd be too puffed out to talk. My assistant and I would simply maintain a comfortable telephone silence, save for the odd whinny of exertion from my end until I reached the brow. She'd really struggle to write as quickly as I was speaking, but that's not my problem. And the last word in Bouncing Back is Allah, he says. He wrote the entire book in 3 weeks. He says it wasn't his first book. This is a revelation. His previous book was A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Stadium to Alan Partridge by Alan Partridge, a wry collection of amusing anecdotes about his experiences as a sports reporter, published by Pear Tree Publishing, the publishing wing of my now defunct company.
Is that referenced in any other Partridge fiction?
I don't think so. This is the first time I knew there was a book before Bouncing Back.
Yeah.
He also says Pear Tree Publishing had gone under years before after an injunction from former goalkeeper Ray Clements, who is real, who angrily questioned the validity of one of the anecdotes. And the title of the anecdote was Clements practicing goalie throws by hurling kids over hedge.
Ray Clements, former England and Tottenham Hotspur goalkeeper.
The only mention that I can find of A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Stadium to Alan Partridge is... there on the very old BBC On the Hour website, there is a reference to it. So
new website.
It has kind of existed in Alan's backstory for a while. But yeah, I don't think it's properly mentioned anywhere else.
Okay. He gets very excited about publishing the book, so he calls his son Fernando. His son says, I'm just in the loo, Dad. He was such a joker. So basically, he has a conversation with Fernando about publishing his book, and then it becomes apparent that Fernando's taking a shit at the same time.
Yeah. I heard a plop.
Either he hadn't been joking about being on the loo, or he was dropping stones into a well.
Every time Alan phone...
he just says... Fancy meeting for a drink to celebrate, but the line went dead.
Yeah. Question to the group. Have you ever taken a phone call whilst doing a poo?
I would probably say yes, but I can't remember specific examples.
All I can say is in work once, I was in a cubicle and someone in the cubicle next to me answered a call. They will remain nameless, but I know.
An extension of that, I've definitely been on WhatsApp to you lot.
Oh, while I've been on the bog.
No. All the time.
I will take a call. It's fine.
I was just going to say, it seems like whenever Alan actually successfully gets through to Fernando on the phone, Fernando's always doing something which makes it a very inconvenient phone call.
In bed with a woman.
In bed with a woman, taking a shit, etc.
So do you think he's actually doing all those? I mean, I think he's taking a shit here. Do you think he's actually doing those things?
I also think he's in bed with a woman as well,
because you sound out of breath.
You've been running.
I just wondered if it was if perhaps he was making those things up because he didn't want to talk to his dad for very long.
I'm sure he would do that as well, even if he wasn't doing anything.
Alan tries to get his book into several different sections: biographies, health and well-being, mind, body and spirit, new releases and bestsellers. I don't think you can be in bestsellers just by asking. He had also penned in 5 to go by the cash tills because he read something about Cadbury's Chomps doing the same to cash in on impulse purchases. There's also an interesting postscript to him saying Fernando had either been on the loo or dropping stones into a well. He wasn't dropping stones into a well. He also sent copies to the widows of Tony Hares and Chris Feather. It was a classy touch, he says. And he sent Denise and Fernando a copy but decided that his wife Carol could buy her own. Also, says, I'd managed to stretch it to over 300 pages. So even by his estimation, he's padding the fuck out of it. Yeah. Sales were disappointing, he says. My refusal to dumb down, if anything, I dumbed up, had cost me dearly. He received word via fax that a lot of stores were going to be taken down from the shelves. And he was absolutely thunderstruck. He says, using Roger's thesaurus, which he also credits with a lot of inspiration for the words he used in the book itself. He desperately...
He basically demands that the publishers give it a push and insists on a raft of nationwide TV adverts to give the book the push it deserves. I'd brace yourself, Alan. That is not going to happen.
Not a chance.
Thankfully, he says, they did hammer out a compromise, which is that they're not going to run a series of nationwide TV.
When was the last time you saw a book advertised on TV?
That's so good. He literally writes, instead of running a series of nationwide TV adverts, they were not going to run a series of nationwide TV adverts.
He also makes reference to the bit we see in I'm Alan Partridge of him flogging copies of his own book at the train station with a Danko nightstick.
It's concourse retail in its purest form.
Yes. He also, in that bit, he describes like he sees himself as a viable alternative to the W.H. Smiths that's at the same station as well.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
He also says he resembled a market trader, but he was in fact a bookshop without walls.
And only selling one book.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, and a Danko nightstick.
Oh, he has got
Danko. As used in futuristic TV shows, The X-Files.
It's probably briefly worth giving back to. During the time, he says he can't recall a lot of the exact details because he was drinking a lot of cider. He doesn't really like cider, but there was a very good deal on at Thresher's. And this explained his somewhat distracted response when Lynn phones him with the good news about the book deal. and then when Lynn comes round, he says, "Could get me some crisps." The next day, though, all the cider has now been drunk, spilled, or thrown. So then he's shaped up.
So basically, he's almost going down the Dave Clifton route now, isn't he?
Well, that's actually a bit of viable drink hack.
Yeah.
Yeah. Shame it wasn't in the drink heck chapter, really, exactly, isn't it? Yeah. He basically talks one guy at the train station into buying the book, who pays for it by check.
Also, I'd say he can remember this person's name, but he can't remember if it was Pepsi or Shirley that got him on his Toblerone.
Or the name addiction. Of Glenn Ponder's husband.
Yeah.
So the guy pays $8.99. I wonder, do you think that's the original RRP or that's a knockdown price? It does include Danko Firestick as well.
I think that guy's probably getting, oh, I was going to say a deal, but it's not that much of a deal.
No,
£9.
Not. No,
they're
not really.
A torch pal, but still.
It is a hardback.
Still £9.
And then he gets the bombshell that his book is going to be pulped, which is something he describes as nothing short of literary genocide. he tries to save, he tries to get the nationwide TV adverts going again. That doesn't work. So he then tries to do a stunt where he makes a house out of 1,000 copies of Bouncing Back.
Not a bad idea. That would actually get some copies. On BuzzFeed or something.
I put a note in here that's actually better quick thinking than with Tony Hayes, I thought. He's come up with something viable. He claims to be begging Henry at the publishing company to not pulp it. He says, "I'm literally on my knees." And then Henry says, "Well, it sounds like you're driving." Okay, not literally. Throw me a bone, buddy.
Can I just interrupt very quickly? Short update here. Jed's Kinder Egg toy is a caterpillar. I repeat, that is a caterpillar from Jed's Kinder Egg.
Good work. Great. For those Continue, of you that Adam. Had a caterpillar in your Jed's Kinder Egg I Spy guide, mark it off now. So Henry at the publishing company suggests Alan can go to the pulping of his own book. Alan is apoplectic with anger at the prospect of having to go and do this. And then he immediately cuts to, "I was deeply moved by what I saw at the paper mill the following day." A lovely switch there. There's a nice bit where Alan consoles himself about the pulping of his book by imagining what it might be turned into. An A4 jot book from Ryman's, a love letter from one man to his troubled bisexual fuck buddy, or maybe a ream of high-grade printer paper purchased by a thriving local business shoved into the tummy of a Canon IP2000. It would bide its time until one day emerging kicking and screaming into the world, caked in the latest set of company financials. Of those three, the one I'm least keen on is the fuck buddy.
That's brilliant, because that didn't have to be an option.
No, exactly. That is a brilliant paragraph. There is one option, though, that he's not prepared to entertain.
And what's that?
That it basically be end up as toilet paper, which is why he will insist on buying foreign these days, which is probably the only instance of him insisting on buying something foreign and not British.
Yes.
Yeah. Apart from possibly Sonia.
True.
Did any money exchange hands with Sonia?
I don't think it did, but I think his
later on it does.
Let's talk about that later.
Later on it does.
Okay. If books really do need to be destroyed, he screamed at the foreman over the deafening roar of machinery. This is definitely the most humane way of doing it, yeah, because books have feelings.
And there's a bit more in the DVD of I'm Alan Partridge Series 2 where he's at the paper mill, because I think they the pulping plant because I think they kind of incorporate it into the menu. So there is a longer scene of him like trying to chat to the foreman or whatever.
Oh, but yeah, just following him around the building.
Yeah, yeah, and like they can't really hear each other over the noise and stuff.
Amazing. That brings us more or less to the end of the chapter. Has anyone else got anything for chapter 28?
No. No.
Okay, chapter 29 is titled Good Grief.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Okay, you have one piece of mandatory listening for this chapter, which is Drive by The Cars. Great song.
It starts with Alan talking about the recent funerals he's attended. Obviously, there's Tony Hares, Chief Commissioning Editor of BBC Television, Chris Feather, Chief Commissioning Editor of BBC Television, Mum and Dad, brackets my mum and dad, and don't know name, the racist mother of the woman who works for me. How can he not know Lynn's mum's name? That
or just
terrible.
Ask her.
Yeah. And certainly don't leave it as a placeholder in the book.
Yeah, but do we know, on the audiobook, how do they deal with that gag?
It says, don't know name.
Okay, brilliant.
So Lynn's mum obviously died and he gave her 36 hours off. I looked up the legal allowance. As far as I can tell, it's entirely up to your employer's discretion.
So it's fine then.
Bad news if your employer's Alan Partridge. Yeah.
Talk us through how FlexiGrief works.
He then had to later qualify that by saying that she wasn't allowed to take them all in one go. Instead, the allotted hours may be taken at any time in the next month, but in units of no more than 3 hours. A system, another system,
yep.
FlexiGrief, he's calling it, he's basically invented.
Although, I like, he's kind of given it an interesting qualification. He says, what would happen if a person took a straight 36 hours off, but then grief hit when that person was back at work doing, I don't know, her employer's quarterly underwear shop?
So he's worried about lost productivity, basically. Yeah.
There's a little note on for the underwear shop in the footnote. Always M&S unless finances were tight, in which case I'd cut the budget and send her to Next.
As long as he's not buying them himself.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I was going to say a touching moment, but my note here actually says, as touching a moment as you're going to get, where he's talking to Lynn about her dead mum. And he says, good, I wanted to check on you in an arm around the shoulder kind of way, although there was absolutely no physical contact between us. Because your lip was wobbling, it looked like you were, you know, thinking of things you should have said. Suddenly, my assistant burst into tears. So she had been upset after all, she told him she hadn't. The little fibber, I didn't mind, though. She was a mum down. I pointed to a box of tissues.
I like that he feels a need to reconcile the grief as well. So obviously 36 was the target. He's reconciled it and it's come to 40, thus meaning she was 12% more sad than he thought.
Also, three exclamation marks when he realised it's come
absolutely.
To 40 hours. So he decides it's time to get her back to work. To start the healing process, he had her buy and assemble, then disassemble and return a gas barbecue, which he didn't even need.
Yeah, he's already got one.
Yeah. I also like his footnote, about barbecues, describing them as a place where you can play it safe with sausages or become the talk of the town with a delicious spatchcock chicken.
To be fair, Stab is a big fan of a spatchcock chicken.
I'm a big fan of a spatchcock chicken.
Love a spatchcock.
What I'm disputing is that one spatchcock chicken would make you the talk of the town.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm the talk of Southeast London with my spatchcock chicken, let me tell you that.
Is it worth also just picking up that the death of Lynn's mother, according to Alan, he says, my assistant's loss is the black community's gain. Really ramming home that racism there.
Yeah, she's hugely racist. He says, both of my own parents are also thoroughly dead. I have to be honest and say I wasn't too cut up when Popper passed on. Our relationship had been so complex I could write a book on it. What do you reckon, Harper Collins? So I thought, is this the first kernel of an idea that leads to Nomad? Because part of the premise of Nomad is him making a pilgrimage that his father once took.
That's a very interesting spot, yeah. Mm.
I mean, he's basically out and out asking HarperCollins to commission it, so it seems that way.
I wonder if they were already planning a second book by this point. Like, possibly not, because I guess they didn't know how successful this is going to be.
He does say, seriously, let me know, because I can easily turn around a Ms. Lit book. Arguably, this is a Ms. Lit book.
Yeah. This is, yes.
And also, it's hard to describe what it's like to lose your mother, but HarperCollins have insisted I try.
Yeah, and it's worth noting that HarperCollins didn't actually publish Nomad, the quote-unquote second Alan Partridge book. It was actually published by Orion.
Oh, so basically HarperCollins didn't take Alan up on his offer.
He said he could chuck out a Ms. Lit book, and they said, no thanks, Alan.
Right, back to Alan's dead mum. HarperCollins have prompted him for some observations about his mum. Just a few highlights here. He complains that her teats weren't much of a chef. It was milk every day, for goodness sake.
What was he expecting? Oreo milkshakes?
He also says, I'd rarely even let her do my blackheads. Question to the group, do you let other people squeeze your spots? I never have.
No.
Absolutely not. Well,
sounds
actually,
gross.
I think...
Oh, hang on.
I think a rather awkwardly placed one that was probably popped by an apartment or something.
It is the most unpleasant thing to think about. It's
so gross.
Think about it.
Really think about it.
You know both people were concerned in this conversation. Have a think.
He says his mum would absolutely insist on watching Know Me, Knowing You if she was at home when it was on. It was different when I returned to radio. She didn't listen to Norfolk Nights on too late, Up with a Partridge on too early, or Mid Morning Matters dead. And then he says, to preserve her dignity, I'd rather not say what she died from, but suffice to say, the family was forced to ask some rather uncomfortable questions about what she used to get up to in her spare time. Question to the group, would you like to speculate on Alan's mum's cause of death?
Wait, is there something about it being closed casket as well?
Yeah. He brought her body back from Hull, don't ask. The coroner had concluded his post-mortem, long story. We were free to arrange the kind of funeral we knew she would have wanted, minus the open casket. Believe me, you don't want to know. Well,
and also, preserving dignity, her dignity has not been preserved at all in this book.
No. I'm not sure that I do want to wildly speculate, because the implication is it's very bad.
Yeah. And it's happened mainly to her face.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Let's move on.
Rest in peace, Dorothy Partridge.
Yeah, R.I.P.
He finds radio is his sort of calming influence in times of trouble. He says when he became so grief-stricken, he barely knew what he was saying. For a while, he thought he was broadcasting. Uncle Peter said that at one point during the funeral, he tried to introduce Cool for Cats by Squeeze.
Which I think is a shame that that's therefore not the soundtrack for this chapter.
Yeah, very true. Very true.
But it made sense.
I like that's his comfort zone, is entertaining the people. He says it was a bit of a daze around that period. He remembers eating a great many chicken drumsticks and someone coming up to him and telling him he mustn't forget to have fibre too. The last thing he wants is to be bereaved and bunged up.
It's a fair point.
And then eventually he starts sending Lynn to his mum's grave so he doesn't have to go. His graveside representative, he said. He reasoned that as a believer, his assistant derived more meaning from graveside grieving than he did. He said, don't get me wrong, it's good stuff. If you find it comforting, go there. Oh, he's talking about heaven there.
Yeah, and also he does say that if he was pushed for time, he would just open his passenger side window and throw the flowers out without stopping as well. It may sound crass, but in many ways it's a tribute to my mum, because she was a real stickler for punctuality. And then, not that the flowers always land in the right place.
They landed on the grave of Dan, loving father and loyal husband, Faversham, apparently. It said, occasionally other mourners will see this happening and frown. I can only assume they think I'm a predatory gay with a fetish for the dead. And I know that would have made mum chuckle. Interesting
why
point.
Why does it have to be a predatory gay?
I can only assume.
That's the logical conclusion.
And that brings us to the end of Good Grief, Alan's dispatch about the deaths of all of the big people in his life. Brings us to chapter 30, Classic House. So, talk to me about the Alan's mandatory music choices to listen to while we're discussing Classic House.
Well, Adam, the soundtrack for this chapter is Satisfaction by Benny Benassi, with an additional note from Alan saying, check out the video.
Has everyone checked out the video?
No.
No.
You should, it's good.
Really?
Yes. Let's cut to Nick's live reaction.
Push me, and then just touch me, till I can get my satisfaction.
Push me, and then just touch me, till I can get my satisfaction. Satisfaction.
Okay, Nick, here we go. It's Benny Benassi, it's Satisfaction. What are your immediate thoughts?
Yeah, I do know the song. Awful song, but fair play, they have smashed the video.
So you're very much with Alan on, at this point.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Do you want me to keep it running? Or?
Yeah, if you like.
Yeah, okay, we'll just put it on mute.
Yeah, just keep it running in the background.
Distracted enough.
Alan lays into Grand Designs as he starts to describe the house that he was attempting to make. He complains about architects and advertising agencies having just names of the owner's surnames, Beeden, Allison, Lyons, and he goes on to name.
There's a lot of name listing in this chapter, isn't
there?
He suggests that it would be better if they called themselves Rocksteady if they're architects. This does exist. Well, architect plans for a Rocksteady Studios exist. At least, right. And Pizzazz Advertising, that does exist. Pizzazz Promotions makes promotional products, and their caption says, "Let your logo do the talking."
Wow.
No longer trading.
Pizzazz.
Yeah. Let's run through the names he looks at for the property. We have done this as a bit of a quiz before.
Sorry,
but
I was about to say that's like Tangent Snowball, but was Tangent Snowball a real thing?
Tangent Snowball was a real
yeah,
agency.
So it's good that I didn't do that.
He gives us all of the suggested names for the property. We've done these as a quiz before, but let's run through them. Always nice to revisit.
Talk us through it, yeah. Mm.
Coleman House, Atlantis, Ace House, Allen House, The Cottage, The Old Rectory, Barn Cottage, Follyfoot, Steed Manor, Lord House, Rockford House, Flambards, Brideshead House, The Skirmishes, Apache, Tomahawk, Skepta House,
Scepter House.
The Cinnamons, it's just a lovely ingredient, Classic House, The Classics, Manor House, Bentley House, and Large Cottage. So which is the best and why?
Oh, well, The Cinnamons, it's just a lovely ingredient.
I'm a big fan of The Cinnamons as well. I think if I was to choose a house name from all of those, I'd probably
choose
The
Cinnamons. It's kind of like the least tacky out of all of those options, isn't it?
I'm also a big fan of the way he pronounces Flambards in the audiobook. Yeah.
Flambards.
I'm going to go Flambards because that's the name of an underachieving theme park in the southwest.
So I was going to ask where that comes from.
Name your house about something underachieving. Definitely a great idea.
Sure. Very on brand with Alan.
So, and just to clarify, he chooses Classic House out of this list, doesn't he? Indeed, so that's the house we see him, well, that's the house we see being built.
Yes. Yeah. They does say, the Linton Travel Tavern had made it abundantly clear that I was welcome back at any time.
I really don't think they had.
As we know from previous episodes, he claims a lot of people have said he's welcome back at any time, and he absolutely is not.
Their eyes seem to suggest.
But in the meantime, he's staying, as we know, in a static caravan, a 10-footer from the yet-to-be-better Delta Range.
Good enough for Jimmy Savile.
Good enough for Alan Partridge. It still exists. They're based in Hull in East Yorkshire. Their models include Superior, Hadley, Molina, Ascot, Bromley Deluxe, Bromley, Resort Plus, and Santana.
Well, which one would Alan choose?
Santana. Yeah. I will never, ever, ever, ever understand caravans and their appeal. Despite holidaying in them much as a child, I don't understand the appeal.
I understand the logistical point of them. I don't understand the practical.
Well, it takes out the endless hassle of having to move from room to room.
There you go. He's done you.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you could literally just park them up anywhere, I would like that freedom. But why would you? No. Just no. As he says, as you mentioned, for some time, Jimmy Savile lived in a caravan and absolutely insists it was a lifestyle choice. Scruffy crooner David Essex also lived in one. We can't verify those claims.
At this point, when the book had been published, had Savile's name been discredited, or was he still the bastion of all things good?
Well, Stav, when did the book come out?
So the book came out on the 29th of September 2011.
Right, okay. So Savile died on the 29th of October 2011. Right. So I think all the
They didn't write
horrendous
this for a year. Or,
yeah, and also all the horrendous revelations about him came out post-death.
And
so,
I would say that when Savile died, this book would have already been in production. It would have been, they couldn't have changed it.
Yeah. Okay. He says that living in a caravan, he hoped would give him a chink of insight into the mindset of the travelling community so that he might come to understand how they could even consider dumping a bin bag full of used nappies in the ginnel next to someone's house. speaking from personal experience there, isn't he? He also says, Pear Tree Productions had been a great success having achieved everything it set out to, and so when its mission accomplished, it was placed into liquidation.
I love that.
Great success.
Which means that Pear Tree Factual Productions that did Welcome to the Places and Scissor Dial was an entirely separate company.
A new entity.
Yeah. Well, in fact, I wonder if he basically, Pear Tree had to be forced into liquidation. He wanted to keep making programs. Mm. How can he do it by making documentaries under a different name?
Also, doesn't he later refer to the Apache group of companies? He's got a burgeoning media empire.
His new and exciting venture, the Apache group of companies. Apache group of companies does exist. It sells used cars and motor vehicles, but Partridge is not listed among the directors on the company's house website.
So, as Monkey Tennis, have we achieved everything that we set out to achieve? So, should we be placed immediately into liquidation?
Well, dear listener, get in touch, right? Perhaps we should run a Twitter poll to that effect.
Not another Twitter poll.
No.
The Apache group of companies comprised six distinct brands: Apache Communications, Apache Production, Apache Office Supplies, Apache Media Training, Apache Risk Management, the tagline for which is "Trust No One," stolen from futuristic TV series The X-Files, and Apache Military Strategy, which I like to think Michael was involved in somehow as a consultant.
I like his addendum to that. It was a welcome revenue stream that complemented Brand Partridge beautifully.
He goes on to talk about Choristers and how much he loved that. He got membership at this point. He says there's one in Norwich, one in Bristol, one in Chester, and one at Stansted Airport.
Have you checked
the key places?
Yes, of course I have. It doesn't exist, but there is. It was actually filmed, the Choristers scenes, at the Wildwood Golf and Country Club in Surrey. But no, Choristers as a country club does not exist. Speaking of Choristers, he also manages to eventually ban children entirely
after several years of lobbying,
which is probably a process that started when he tried to ban the young chap of about six wearing denim in I'm Alan Partridge.
Todd. Really? Seriously.
Of Apache, he says, some people think it didn't work. Some people think it didn't have its fair share of work, but they're wrong because it did.
No more qualification. Yeah, that's it.
No.
Just trust him on that one.
It seems that he went into the corporate video or the corporate presentation market because they were easy to satisfy, and their idea of entertainment is generally limited to a Dilbert cartoon or the use of Comic Sans font in an otherwise serious PowerPoint. Although he's gone into the corporate world, he does have some scruples. He wasn't going to do a motivational presentation plus rock music for a cigarette brand because his assistant's racist mother had just died of lung cancer, but then it turned out they were paying $5,000, so he changed his mind.
What are you going to do?
I'll take the money, thanks.
He is prepared to work with toxic brands. Please remember that.
And he sort of reviews but doesn't review his own presentation for that cigarette brand. He just says, of that, I was paid in full. He's opted for the name Classic House. We know that now.
Yeah.
And he's been promoted to Radio Norwich's glamour slot, Norfolk Nights.
It didn't get any better than that, apparently. That's his words,
though. The glamour slots. I mean, what?
There's no glamour slot on Radio Norwich.
What do we think he means by that?
Well, apparently his is the glamour slot, and Dave Clifton is very much on the graveyard shift.
Yeah, and on the bottle. He says no amount of polo mints could mask that. I also like his description. He basically compares.
I know where you're going. He compares the
technique of him G-ing up his audience so that they can sit through Dave's boring show. Compares it to the slingshot technique used to propel the Galileo probe out into the solar system, which he describes as saying they basically razzed it round the sun a few times. So that's what he does before pelting his audience into the atmosphere-free void of Dave's slot.
It's probably just worth also mentioning there's a bit of statistical discussion about Mid-Morning Matters. So he puts in speech marks, statistics say that 80% of women under the age of 30 are either indifferent to or actively dislike my current show, Mid-Morning Matters. And then he says, that doesn't make it true.
But it is from a North Norfolk Digital Listener Survey, June 2011.
Yeah.
He starts talking about Sonia as well. He's now going.
Yeah,
out
so this
Sonia.
Is the first mention of Sonia in the book, right?
Yes.
Yep.
33, and she's significantly younger than him, 14 years younger. And he says that his new slot gives him a metaphorical hand job, but then feels necessary to define hand job as manual masturbatory relief by a consenting foreign hand.
But then, less metaphorically, the new love in his life, Sonia, is also doing that. Yes,
and this is when he says, press play on Benny Benassi, Satisfaction.
I see. Right. Yeah.
Did anybody spot the fleeting Jill reference in this?
Truly distasteful dalliance with a menopausal member of staff years earlier.
Distasteful.
Poor Jill.
That is awful.
She doesn't deserve that.
He also says, my sex life post Carol had been as threadbare as the gusset of my number one dad novelty briefs. Do we think he bought them for himself?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah.
He was introduced to Sonia by Pete Gabatas, who we've discussed before, the MD of Blue Barn
Media.
Yes,
and the fact that he used the phrasing that Pete had arranged similar girlfriends for six or seven of us, I think that implies that money has exchanged.
Yeah, and
money
has changed. Mine was probably the second best. Not even the best.
I also,
that means he was looking at one of his friend's wives going, oh, yours is better than mine.
Probably thinking, oh, I'd love to have it off with her.
Yeah.
I also love that he writes, within reason, I loved every minute of my time with Sonia.
He's also used the word pubing again. Stop using the word pubing!
Yet that she was so youthful, he'd started pubing before she was even born.
Yes. I like the distinction between the window sticker that Sonia's made for the caravan versus Alan. Hers says, if the caravan's rocking, don't come knocking. And his says that he had to make it himself. If it looks like we're having sexual intercourse in here, please respect our privacy.
Do we think, though, that the builders were coming in, though, and not respecting their privacy?
Yes.
I don't believe it to be true.
I don't know, because the builders are a bit cheeky. They're a bit naughty.
I'm not sure they're disrespectful, but
they say to her, you could sit on his face in I'm Alan Partridge.
They were spying on him.
Help me out, mate. I also enjoy Alan saying that Sonia had achieved through genetics and poverty the exact body shape that Carol had been fruitlessly striving for since she was 20.
The poverty diet. He would have made a book or video about that.
Absolutely. It's another one of his systems.
It just works.
He also describes Sonia as energetic, boisterous, and very, very zesty.
Smash and grab sex,
and
or
also
a ram raid.
No, that'd be awful.
A ram raid. And that he had her fully checked out before anything happened.
Yeah,
and insists that the bath he insists a new lover takes with three caps of Dettol is sexy and hygienic.
I don't know what that achieves, but
it's the cleanliness obsession, isn't it?
Yeah, true.
Yeah,
I guess so.
Well, what else would it achieve apart from cleanliness?
Well,
godliness,
a lovely smell.
A bath of Dettol is not a lovely smell.
No, I'm joking. There's a bit of a revelation here that he says, we broke up, him and Sonia, just hours after the house was completed.
Yeah.
So I think that is literally minutes after the end of the last episode of Iron Man and Partridge.
That'd be great. That's I think you're bang on there.
Yeah, straight away. And the reason is that because it's a new build, he wanted shoes off at the door and she was hopeless at remembering.
And as we've seen, those kind of final scenes with their house being completed in Iron Man and Partridge, Lynn has shoe covers on as well. So that's a very strict rule for Alan.
He says that breaking the news to her wasn't easy. We've been living together for a year and a half and she'd often talked about marriage, ideally to me, but I'd approach anyone with UK citizenship. Yeah. So question to the group, did Sonia really love Alan?
No.
I think she did
as well.
Yeah.
No, I think
to
she's
put
saying
up
that,
with that. Jesus
yeah, but
Christ.
I think she just thinks she but I reckon she's just thinking, I've got an idiot here, this is an easy way to get a passport. I'm just going to go along with it.
No.
I think
she's
I think there was
genuine,
I think
yeah,
there was some affection
I
there.
I do as well, yeah.
Which makes it all the worse that, that when it comes time to dump her, Alan gets Lynn to do it.
Awful.
Whilst he's locked himself in the toilet.
Yeah. Yes.
Sorry, the bathroomette.
Poor kid, I thought, as I did my belt up.
Oh, yeah, I love that. So he's locked himself in the toilet to get Lynn to basically dump Sonia. And because he's locked in the toilet, he thought, might as well take a shit whilst I'm here.
Yep. And then I think possibly the best part of this story is that later on, because of Lynn's bad lying, he fines her £10.
Yeah.
Also, he says, Alan, I love you. She kept shouting, Sonia, not my assistant.
Oh, and then there's a brilliant payoff here that Sonia is now his cleaner.
Yep.
Yes.
And Sonia, well, she and I are still very close in the sense that she's now my cleaner. I wish things had turned out differently, but I'm glad they didn't.
That is one of my favourite lines in the book. Yeah. I love that.
And it's delivered brilliantly in the audiobook as well.
I'm not saying this is essential, but you have skipped over a very important bit about Bid Up TV. So he's very angry that Sonia hasn't left after Lynn's dumped her on his behalf because he was promised he was going to send a showreel to Bid Up TV. Does anyone remember Bid Up TV?
I do. Yep. I also used to buy things from it.
Did you?
What?
What did you buy?
Christmas presents.
What?
Chintz and tat.
Yeah. I used to love Bid Up TV. I would watch it all the time.
Right, I want a list of things you bought.
Yes.
Tell us more.
A pair of pyjamas.
Why not just get pyjamas from a
M&S?
Yeah. Why are you buying it on Bid Up TV?
Because the principle of Bid Up TV is that the price starts high and then it goes down.
Yeah, but they
the
add £8 postage and packing to everything.
Yeah, but low prices.
Okay. Well, here's some Bid Up TV facts.
Hang on.
No, we need more.
We need more.
Tell us more.
That's already happened. So tell us more.
I went through a phase of buying stuff on Bid Up TV. Some of them including Christmas.
Were
presents.
You boozed up on drink when you were watching it as well?
No, but it was also good viewing in the evening as well.
Would you say you look back on this period with a mixture of fondness and pride?
Yeah, And if I had Sky now, I assume it's still going.
That was going to be my next question.
I'm trying to get to the facts, but you keep talking.
Sorry.
All right, Adam, to the facts.
Bit Up TV went bust in 2014 after
because Nick wasn't buying enough product.
After a rebrand in 2005. A fact I didn't realise is that Keith Harris of Orville fame once presented on Bit Up TV as
did
well.
Did not know.
Yeah, so there we go. One more thing. He says that his house that he moved into alone had four good-sized bedrooms, and he used to alternate between rooms one and four, leaving two Fernandos and three Denise's untouched in case they dropped by and needed to go to sleep. Firstly, I like the fact that Denise's room obviously comes after Fernando's.
Yeah.
Question to the group. I think we know the answer. Has either child ever visited?
No. And also, as we know from I'm Alan Partridge, that he basically sets up the lounge in a small room that is essentially the same size and layout of the caravan.
And on that bombshell, I think that brings us to the end of that chapter and the end of this episode of Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge fan podcast. Thanks so much for joining us. You can get in touch, thepartridgepod@gmail.com. We're at thepartridgepod on Twitter, facebook.com/thepartridgepod, or on Instagram, monkeytennispod. We'll be back next week with Forward Solutions and the final installment of the chapters from iPartridge. We need to talk about Alan. From all of us at Monkey Tennis, thank you so much and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Monkey Tennis?
Smelly Alan Partridge.
Linton Travel Tavern seemed an obvious choice.
Monkey Tennis?
At the BBC of all places. Be real.
Monkey Tennis?
Where's my assistant? I do not know.
Monkey Tennis?
I wish things had turned out differently, but I'm glad they didn't.
Monkey Tennis?
It will be called Alan's Show. I decided, and would be absolutely ace.
Monkey Tennis?
But needless to say, I had the last laugh.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.